Greetings, Earthlings, do-gooders, culture makers, and storytellers. Welcome to another episode of the Slow Dive Podcast. I am your host, Farida, and today we chat with another illuminating creative, author, filmmaker, video editor, Acer Salman. Acer Salman is a filmmaker and author with a primary focus on projects that shed light on underrepresented communities. As an editor, her work in docuseries is Clio and Emmy-winning. Born in Iraq and growing up in Kentucky with a brief stint in Saudi Arabia, Acer constantly felt like a fish out of water. This nomadic childhood shaped her interest in storytelling. After graduating from the University of Kentucky School of Journalism, Acer worked as a local news producer before coming to Los Angeles for film school. Since then, she's been a story producer editor for studios such as Miramax Films, Disney, Universal Pictures, The Weinstein Company, Netflix, and FX. Acer also teaches writing classes and workshops to help new writers find their authentic voice so they too can tell the story most true to themselves. Welcome to the Slow Dive Podcast, Acer. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you, Farida. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, thank you for joining us. So I'm going to ask you, when was the last time you wrote a handwritten letter?
I wrote a thank you note last night.
That's an easy one. Okay, well, that is good. Okay, so people appreciate handwritten letters, right?
I love it. A friend of mine took me out for my birthday, which was a couple of days ago, and so I sent her a little thank you card. So yeah.
Oh, happy belated birthday too!
I'm just kidding.
Happy belated birthday. That's lovely. Okay, well, what is a lost art or fading art that, in your opinion, needs to be revived?
A lost art or a fading art that needs to be revived? Well, handwriting letters, obviously. That is a good question. There's so many. Here's a great one. They used to have these things back in the day, the salons, you know, where, you know, it was really kind of sort of for the elite and intellectuals would gather and discuss ideas. And I just love that, not the elite necessarily, the intellectual elite part, but I love the idea of just getting together with friends and just having conversations like that. I guess today it would be like games night or something like that. But I find that I'm always, you know, I feel like I love that idea of just like having friends just get together to discuss. Well, and you know what? Actually, book club is probably the closest thing to that. But if it was something where you can just host a salon, I think I know that they're out there, but I feel like in my life, I don't see them enough.
You should host one and then invite all of us. What do you think is the appeal of the salons that you like?
It's just the idea of having conversation with people about not the usual things that you have conversations with, you know, like I don't, you know, when I get together with my friends, it's always, you know, oh my God, did you hear what happened in the news and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, like maybe a little gossip about our friends, whatever. But it's, I miss the, you know, discussing a topic, just a random topic.
The intellectual discourse and the exchanging of ideas.
Discourse. It doesn't need to be intellectual because it could go off. Yeah. It could be nonsense. But I miss that. I miss having just bantering with friends and things like that. So I guess, yeah, probably a book club would be.
Yeah. Maybe. You know, I know you're an author and we're going to get into that, but like some book clubs are just like just excuses to get together. We never discuss the books. It's just like, oh, well, we have this book, but no one's read the latest chapter and we're just going to, you know, talk about stuff. And it's just community building too, right? It's just having that anchor. So yeah, I love that. Acer, what cartoons did you watch growing up?
We had a lot of, I lived in Saudi Arabia for a good portion of my kind of, you know, later childhood. So like from 9 to like 12. So I was still watching cartoons. So we had a lot of like random cartoons, like maybe British ones, or maybe older ones. Like there was something called the Shmoo.
Okay.
Like, oh, you know what? All the Hanna-Barbera ones were great.
Yeah.
come on, there's nothing that I, the only cartoons I did not like so much were the genre ones, like the robot-y ones. My brother would watch those, but I didn't really like that, those cartoons. What kind of cartoons did you watch? Now I'm curious.
Yeah, no, I like the Jetsons and then the Flintstones. I don't know, they were just very basic. But yeah, I also like the Warner Brother cartoons, you know, like the Coyote and the Roadrunner and like Elmer Fudd. But like, I actually grew, I don't know about you, but like, I'm gonna date myself here, but like I grew up watching like the Addams Family and the Munsters and like the black and white, like crazy family sitcoms. And those were like, those were really, they were very helpful in shaping my creative background. So I'm just like, I always like to know what other creatives, you know, what their childhood favorites were, because it kind of shows up later. Like you see those like interests show up and emerge in their different pieces. And it says a lot about a person, I think. So now that I know what your favorite cartoons are, some of the ones you grew up watching, we're going to talk about your origin story and how that drove your storytelling and then representation and what that means for you. So I'm going to read a quote that I read. I'm going to read a quote by Reza Aslan about your book, The Wrong End of the Table. The Wrong End of the Table is an insightful and enjoyable look at one of the most contested and misunderstood minorities in America today, Muslims. Through her own life story, Aisar Salman uses her experiences to distill not just Islam, but also the impact religion and culture have on how we interact and understand the world around us. What emerges is that rare voice that is both relatable and unafraid to examine the complexities of her American identity as a minority, an immigrant, and a woman. Very lovely quote by Reza Aslan about your book.
Very complimentary.
Yeah. Well, tell me about why this book and what was the experience of growing up in Kentucky for you and your family?
You know, I was born in Iraq. We moved with my family over here to the States when I was a toddler, you know, for many reasons, for political reasons, for family reasons, for all of the reasons, you know, the family wants us to have a better life in America, all of the things. Right. So my English was not my first language. I spoke Arabic at first. And so I came here and I was learning with my mother kind of, and I just, you know, I was apparently when I was a baby, I was a very outgoing, but then when I came here, either it coincided with this period of introversion or shyness. I think I am now also, I feel like I'm outgoing, but also, you know, very introverted. I value my quiet time and all that kind of thing. And I've learned how to modulate that. Right. But when I was younger, I just felt like I just was off all the time, you know? Mm-hmm. And it stands to reason that you have that with because you're coming in, you're a fish out of water. And when your family is also trying to fit in, it doesn't give you that. You have a little bit of a buffer when you're at home and your family says, you know, it's okay, this means this. But it's not like when you're a kid and you go to school and you're like, you have a weird experience and your mom's like, oh, when I was a kid, I had this. Mm-hmm. Just don't worry about it, because they didn't have the same experience. We were all kind of learning it. So I just felt, out. I felt like like off and out of sorts. And I think I turned inward, and I would do a lot of these, like, you know, create these plays, like all the kids do, create plays with my dolls, or like I did a lot of, I pretended I was a radio personality a lot. Mm-hmm. Like we would have these, we had this station wagon, and back then, you know, seatbelts weren't a thing. So I mean, I don't know if you maybe how old you are in that term regard, but it would be in the back of the, you know, you'd have the middle and then we'd just be in the back and just laying there. And I remember driving home and, you know, from whatever, some event that my parents had gone to, and, you know, in the reflection of the window, I was pretending like I was in, like being, you know, like doing sort of like, I don't know, like, those old timey shows where the host was just like enshrouded in black or something. I don't know. I cannot remember what that is, but like I'm picturing Vincent Price, and I'm picturing me, but you know, so anyway, so I would randomly make up stories and stuff. And I don't like horror movies, but for some reason they always had a horror bent. I think maybe that's, I don't write them. I don't like them. They freak me out. But at the time, so I would do all that. And it just led into me writing story. You know, I've kept a diary since I was 11, and that was great for me. And I just, you know, it was a way for me to turn inward and also express myself in a way that I didn't know was, you know, expressing my creativity. I just thought I was just going to put this down here because I need to tell someone, and this, you know, I'm the only one that's going to understand. And so, you know, cut 2 years later, when I was writing, I found that I was writing a lot of stories that were about my family, and they had narratives, and they had like the engine of the story. But a lot of them were very vignette-y, and I had a mentor. And so I was at the time looking to break into TV as a TV writer. And so a mentor had told me, why don't you write these essays, publish them? I had a blog, you know, everybody had a blog. And so I had a blog. Why don't you self-publish it and we can use it as IP and go into media? And I thought, well, that's a cool idea. And I had the idea, but I thought, oh, this is great. I'm going to put this on next on the list. And I did it. And I got lucky in that an agent was interested in the stories. And, you know, he's like, you don't need to self-publish it. We can find a publisher. And this was all around 2016. So, you know, Muslims were just beginning to become, Muslims were becoming interesting in a positive way, not, you know, in a post 9/11 way. There was that wave as well, but it was, you know, Donald Trump 1.0 was beginning. And so people, you know, my group wasn't the only malign group. Right. And so interested. We just kind of, he and I developed it together, and I had never thought about writing a book before in my life. I think when I was a kid, you know, they say, what do you want to be? Well, a veterinarian or a writer. But, you know, I did not, when I came to film school many years ago, I came with the idea of being, with the intention of being a filmmaker, a director. I think writing would be a necessary thing to get there, but never thought I would. And I can't tell you how much I enjoyed the process. It was very freeing because for two reasons. It's like you're writing prose and kind of anything goes, versus when you're working in screenplays, you know, it's very formatted and you need to stay within the format and all that kind of thing. Not that book writing doesn't have a format, but it was that. And then it was also, this was the first time I'd written as myself. I'd written as Acer Solomon instead of, you know, hiding. Well, not, I shouldn't say hiding, but when you write, when you create characters, you're always, you know, a little bit of yourself, but you're not, the character isn't Acer. The character is, you know, Sammy or Maha or something like that. And so you can, and you often, when you're writing, you know, when you're writing a film or TV piece or anything fictional, you can put parts of yourself in that, right? Well, here was me as me. And it freaked me out. And I was like, I don't think I can do this. This is, you know, all of the things that you have as a newbie writer, like who's going to care? Oh my God, what if I say something to, you know, offend the people? What if I, you know, most people, you know, I change their names, but there were a couple that they were like, no, just tell a good story. What if, you know, I want to do them right. And so it was stressful in that regard until I realized, you know what, all I can do is just be myself. But it was a whole, like there was a whole 7 or 8 month period of trial and error where we kind of, Marina, my agent and I sort of tested the waters and brought the book out. And I realized that I was so worried about being interesting that I was hiding behind humor, which is what I had done prior to that. It's like, oh, it's going to be funny. And, you know, you can bury really important thematic elements that you don't want to be heavy handed with. You can bury a few humor. Yeah, sure. That's great. But it became like the stand-up routine where a lot of the feedback was, this is charming, but she's getting in her own way. And luckily, you know, we pulled it back and I took a month or so just to think about it. And I luckily in my day job, I'm an editor, and so I've been used to receiving notes and understanding them and interpreting them. So I was able to understand, like, okay, well, I think what I need to do is just, I mean, it sounds really simple and like a no-brainer now, but I needed to be authentic. How can I write? It was, you know, it was being billed as a memoir and a comic memoir. So obviously it's like, you know, exaggerated, and there's things in there for comedic effect, but it needed to be authentic.
Yeah. And what I see from a lot of like creatives and storytellers and filmmakers and writers is that they really do channel their childhood experience into these stories via early on journaling, radio show creating. It's always there as an outlet for expression, but also understanding their experience, which then becomes relatable and to so many. So how has it been received, the book, with other Iraqi Americans or just other immigrant experiences? What kind of feedback have you got?
You know what? It's been a dream. A lot of the feedback that I've received, and by this, I mean like random people that will email me, hey, I read your book, whatever. A lot of it has been non-immigrants who had said, and this was a while ago. So the book came out in 2019. So that, you know, many worlds have happened since then. And I feel like we're kind of in a different place now. Like it's more commonplace, but not that it was not commonplace before, but a lot of people would write, you know, I'm a 40-year-old something white male, and you know, really opened my eyes to this, this, and this, or my daughter has a friend who is from Pakistan, and, you know, it's really nice to connect with her on this regard. And then, you know, I had some, you know, people that were like, I'm Egyptian, but your experience is very similar, and they're all similar, right? You know, and so that was really nice. I think I had, you know, you do the thing at the end of the year. Well, I did this thing at the end of the year. It was actually, I think it was right around COVID time. It was like a year later or something. So, you know, so fine. My mind wasn't right. And I thought, well, I'm going to read every reviews. I'm going to read all the negative reviews. And, you know, it's not like they were horrific, but it was just like, oh, she doesn't go deep enough or whatever. I wanted more. And it was kind of interesting because I thought, well, this is, yeah, it's not a, I think some people expected it to be this sort of, you know, tell all, or that, you know, for all the reasons, for some of the reasons that I was concerned about it, that I was like, well, you know, the only memoir that I know so far, this was at that time, that was written by a Muslim woman, is Malala. And I thought, well, I didn't have these horrific things that happened to me, so who's going to care about my story?
I think that's a really important thing that you just said, because people are probably, there was an expectation of to be more like, maybe informed or centered around maybe more like, I don't know, tragedy, trauma. And then there's like this, there is a, in my opinion, there is a trope, or maybe you could put it better than me, where trauma. People do expect.
Trauma porn? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, trauma porn. Yeah, trauma-centric storytelling, and that when we think of narratives and diverse narratives or immigrant narratives, they have to be sad and they have to be traumatic and they can't be resilient or hopeful or joyful or just funny like yours that are relatable. And I think comedy, of course, is the other side of drama. So there is pain in comedy. Comedy is just one way of delivering that, where it's palatable, where you can process it in a more relatable way, where everyone can take a message from it. So I see that a lot when someone approaches immigrant authors or immigrant narratives. It's always like, well, I need to have something horrific happen in it, but this is a great family. They're just adjusting to this new culture, their new home. And it's funny and it's joyful. And that doesn't do so well in with those people, managers or agents, who are looking for that kind of book to maybe, I don't know, adapt into a film or a TV series. So I do think what you've done, it's great, because there's a lot of joy, you know, like, I mean, there's like, as a Pakistani, like all our stories are not like Malala's stories. There's, unfortunately, what happened with her is awful, but she's done something amazing with her legacy and with that experience. But there's also amazing, happy stories that need to be told too, or just run in the middle class families, just adjusting, just like growing up, you know, I think that's important. So Yeah, I like how, do you have plans to do something with your book as far as like a TV series, maybe, perhaps? Have you thought about that?
Yes, I have. We've been in talks. It was being developed, and then, you know, it's kind of a lot of egos get in, and at the moment it's in development, and then we were kind of pivoting to maybe do it as a feature. Mm-hmm. So it's been in different iterations, but yeah, it's I think the thing is, well, I don't know what the thing is. Why, you know, but basically to your point, and one thing that I will say that reminds me of, there was a great movie last year, American Fiction. Did you ever see it?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Oh, it's amazing. It kind of speaks to that. It's like this author, once he kind of leaned in.
Yes. Yeah.
And I kind of felt like that for, on a very small level. I wasn't writing intellectual things. I was just writing this story of just a random person who had this experience that was interesting, you know, enough, and unique, and not the same as somebody else's. And this is the story. And it really was just all about authenticity. And it was all about fitting in and constantly, you know, and when I was writing it, I learned a lot about myself. And so this led to me to teach. I've taught screenwriting through my alma mater, but it led me to teach these workshops about memoir writing. And really, you know, whenever someone asked me, should I, you know, write a memoir? Yes, absolutely. Because yeah, it's like before it was this sort of self-important thing of my memoir, what have I done? Whatever, memoir, whatever. I hate that. But it just, I got to come up with another name for it, but it's just your personal story. And what it does is for any creative or any writer, when you write that story and you're feeling everything, it excavates parts of you that you didn't know that were there. And so, you know, I knew that I didn't fit in Kentucky when I was 9. And then, you know, when we went to Saudi Arabia for a bit, I also had a hard time adjusting more societally and culturally. I had my friends, but then here we are in Saudi Arabia. And this was back then when, you know, women couldn't drive and, you know, all of the things, right? In the 80s. And so there was that amount. There was like, okay, well, you have to look at, if you're crafting a narrative, you have a diary, you can write this stuff. But when you're crafting a narrative story, what's your through line? And so about not fitting in. And then, you know, so I remember I wrote, you know, I had all the chapters. I had, okay, the elementary school years and high school was the worst, because then we came back and I went to a Catholic high school and everybody had been there with each other for 12, you know, for 10 years prior. And I, you know, was coming in and I was the outsider and, you know, not even Catholic, or just going to this private school. And then we get to college. And then suddenly I was like, ooh, now I find my people, whatever. But it was, you know, my agent and the editor was like, well, where's that time period? You know, you had all of these, and then you come back, then you leave Kentucky and come out to Hollywood. And then there's another part of trying to fit in, but where's college? And I realize this interesting aspect is that this whole time in my life, I had this concept that I was the outsider, right? Mm-hmm. And I equated me as the outsider with every other outsider. So I, you know, I was like with my African-American friends, oh, I'm like you. And they're like, we're not, no, you're not like me. And I had this experience in college and where I was being told, I was like, you know, I had this, I realized my privilege, right? That I can, right. I present. I don't, you know, you can see my name and you can think, but I can be from anywhere if you didn't know where I was. But I'm, you know, I present more white than I do African, you know, I don't present African, black, brown, or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I think there's a privilege there that I didn't realize that I was, I had until. Until, I mean, you know, I think when I was younger, I didn't really know. And so when, you know, kind of coincided with me, sort of, you come into your own, like when you're 30s and 40s, right? And like understand. And that's when I wrote this book, is when I was like, oh, wow. Okay. Yes, absolutely. I was able to fit in. And I think I had this privilege because I could become a chameleon. Mm-hmm. I can tell people my name is Lisa and they're like, okay, cool. that I, you know, a lot of some of my friends couldn't do, like, you know, right. Nigeria. And she's like, yeah, I couldn't. That's not what my experience was.
Right.
So it was this very interesting, nuanced thing for me to go, oh, wait a minute. I'm not, just because I'm the other doesn't mean I'm like, there's no one way to be an other. Right.
Right.
And
what? Yeah. No, I it's really fun that you just mentioned that, because I was going to say, how many spaces do you think you live in? Is there a Venn diagram? Do you shift gears? For example, like, you know, and this is not across the board for all creatives. Like, when someone's like, what space do you live in? Do you think of yourself as like, I'm a writer first, I'm a mom first, or a wife or a sister or daughter, or Iraqi American or Muslim American or Southern California? Like, you know how we put ourselves in labels and boxes? Like, how many spaces do you think you live in when you're creating? Or do you shift gears?
When I'm creating or when I'm out presenting?
Because no, when you're creating, when you're actually writing and like thinking of stuff, like, are you just.
Well, I mean, when you're creating, it's basically, it should be you and yourself, and yeah. The idea that nobody's going to see this. So you should, ideally, I would like to think, and I feel like I am at my rawest form, and I don't name it in that regard.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's true. You are writing from the most purest place that of your authentic lived in experience, right? Right. But you can be in different spaces as far as representation is concerned. What do you think, Acer, is the most misunderstood thing about Iraqis in America and the American culture? Do you think, in your experience, you'd like to like destigmatize or illuminate or clarify? I mean, with your experience in Kentucky and then also in Southern California growing up, are there like anything that people get wrong about Iraqis?
Well, I mean, okay, look, the simplest thing is that they're like, oh, Iranian. I'm like, no, it's not Iraq. So that's the only thing. I mean, I haven't honestly, either I've been numb to or neutral to it now, or people know enough that they understand, but I don't know that there is. There was a time about 10 years ago, I would have answered that with a little more, with a little more certainty, but I don't know how to answer that right now, because I haven't come up against that, any misunderstandings.
That's good. Oh. I mean, that's good. That's great, because that's great. And I think, that was a question, because I do think, you know, because you wrote a book, on your experience, and, you know, when people think of Muslims, they think, oh, Muslims are only in the Middle East or MENA regions, but they're all over. And so you can't, our experiences also vary within the Muslim community too, right? Like, I'm South Asian and Middle Eastern, so they vary. So all that plays into then the American culture. And, you know, given what you said, version 2 of Trump presidency is now on board. So it's good. I'm happy to hear that there isn't that, because I know forever in general, people, I mean, unfortunately, have always, like we said, after 9/11, it's always been like, well, you know, Muslims bad, terrorists, Arabs this, bad, or that. So,
well, right. So Iraqis not, but with Muslims, yes, there is a lot of misunderstandings.
So do you miss Kentucky, or is California forever home for you?
I love California, and I feel like I'm now a native, because I've been here for 30 something years.
Oh, wow. Years. Yeah.
But no, I do miss Kentucky. I try to get back there. I have friends. I don't have, my family's not there anymore, but I try to get back, because it's just so beautiful. It's like a different, it's like more like, it's, you know, here has this energy, right? You drive the freeway. You're like, oh, everybody's doing something, whatever. It could be the ions in the ocean. I don't know. But then when I go, it's just kind of more languid and more relaxed. And it's becoming, you know, Lexington, where I'm from, is becoming very artsy, and it's becoming more inclusive and multicultural. And so that's really cool.
This is great. Well, we're going to now get into your career in entertainment. Now, you briefly talked about how you started off in journalism, and then you found yourself editing, and also, of course, you're also creating, producing, and all that stuff, and teaching screenwriting. What is the, for our emerging creatives, what has been the best part of editing, projects or being a story producer on all these, you know, Emmy Award nominated winning, Clio winning projects that you've done. Tell us about that.
Well, the best part is just the creation of it. They're all short form. I love documentary. I love the, finding the story in the edit. And, you know, a lot of these, you know, so I'll get the footage after it's been shot and there's a directive of, oh, we want this, you know, we want it to go in this direction, do this. But then I have the freedom, at least with the first initial cuts, to do whatever I, what I see fit with the story. And it's just so fun to, I mean, I love just listening, you know, being, I can be immersed in an edit and just like the little nitpicky things that people, you know, can't stand with, like listening to something over and over again, just to get it right. And like the frame and all of that. And so I love that part of it. I feel like when I started really seriously writing about 10 years into my editing career, I found that they were both they were, you know, both sides of the same process, or both, yeah, both ends. So writing informed my editing, and then editing informed my writing. And when I tell my students, it's like, here's how you can, you know, you can write punchier scripts, because you can just start thinking about how, when you shoot it and how you can edit and just like, you know, kind of cut it when, and give it a rhythm sort of thing. I don't know. I think editing is my first true love, just because you could just sit there for hours and kind of shape something into something else. And, you know, with music and the stuff that I do is so great, because it's like short form, like I said, short form, and very, you know, a lot of times music driven. And it's just really, you know, it's cool. And it's like, it showcases real people, docu series. And it just kind of shines a light on those communities. And I've been really fortunate in that regard. And so I think,
is there a project that you really enjoyed most working on, or are there a couple of projects you can share with us?
Well, Pose. I love doing Pose, because for all the reasons I said before. But it was just, yeah, it's like these real people. It's this world that you didn't see before, and it was fun, and there's music, and they're, you know, they're funny, and it's sexy, and it's all of the things, right? And I mean, Shogun was the same thing. This summer I worked on I did something for Feud, where it was Zach Posen designed some fashion. He designed all the dresses that were in a particular scene in the Capote's Feud, Black and White Ball, in the show. And so we did this whole like process of him sourcing material and making the stuff, and then, you know, making the dresses, and then, you know, hanging them, and then the final fashion show. And that was really super fun, because I love fashion and music and all of the things. So
yeah, it seems like it's one of those careers where you can just keep your eye on a moving target, and it's always stimulating, and you're never really bored.
I mean, correct. Yeah.
So that's good. So now, has the progression from journalism to story producing and editing, how has that helped you creatively now, like where you are now? Are you looking to do more of that or continue doing that? Or is that like, I know we're going to talk about your short film, but is there more on the horizon with the story producing, or is that something you see yourself doing long term, or is this going to morph into more producing?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I love story producing. I love editing. I love being like, you know, we used to call it predator. We used to call it being a predator, which is kind of
funny. Pre-editor.
Yeah, it's like, because you're producer editor, because they give you the footage and then you cut it together.
Yeah. So
as long as I can do it, I want to do it.
Because yeah,
it's just super fun. And right now I'm doing some stuff for the for the Academy Museum. One of my dreams has always been to cut those montages for the Oscars. And it's not that, but it's like an exhibit in the Academy Museum.
Oh, wow. How congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, yes. That's a very big deal. And I love the Academy Museum. I love it. I'm so happy it's there. It's like, what, the third year now, right? It's like in the third year. Yeah, it's such a beautiful space, and the gallery that they have with the TV screens and the screens and all the archival footage. Is that something that you'll be working on, like the archival pieces maybe?
Right now.
Beautiful.
It's right now, I don't know how it when this is going to, if I should, it's, you know, it's out till June. It's called Color in Motion.
And it's, oh, okay.
Color. It's, yeah, on the, I think it's on, I don't know what floor, third, fourth, but.
How exciting. That's great. That's a piece of, yeah, no, it's a piece of Hollywood history and cinema right there. You're contributing to that. That's so exciting. Well, that, I think it's, that's a highlight, because as an editor, you get to then be in the Academy Museum. Like, does it? That's pretty cool.
Well, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. You have to, like, I mean, if you have a newsletter, definitely send out that blast to your audience when it's, so we can go and appreciate it too. Because I think I don't know if it happened with you, but I think a lot of us, when we're out here in LA for a while, we kind of just don't realize some of the stuff that we're doing is so, like, pretty cool. And it's like where we came from and where we are. And it's like, cause you get lost in the LA scene and it becomes like second nature after a while. And then you're like, wait a second,
right,
20 years ago, I wouldn't have this opportunity if I didn't make this move out here and do that. So there's a level of, like, destiny, fate, fearlessness, and synchronicity, which I think still, even in these uncertain times, make Hollywood such a magical place. And so I think just you saying, like, you know, you started out in Kentucky and now you're editing a piece in the Academy Museum. My goodness, that, like, I will say, mashallah, it's a beautiful thing.
Thank you. It's yeah, it's super fun. I'm very, it's very exciting. It's like, it's, and it's nice to be excited about something that you're working on, you know? So,
yeah. Okay. Well, as we all know, we're all multi-hyphenates and multi-talented. So let's talk about your proof of concept short film, My So-Called Iraqi Wedding. I got to watch it a week ago maybe. Loved it. Hilarious. Really funny. Really quirky. And it gave me, I really liked it. And what I liked, obviously it's a short, it's a proof of concept, but I liked just how lighthearted it was, but also I could see there's more to it from that. And there's more to the story that needs to be told. So my question to you is, before we get into My So-Called Iraqi Wedding, what are your favorite things about Iraqi culture?
The food.
Name a dish so our audience will go try it, because we want to know.
So we have kubba, which is the same thing. So every region, every Arabic, well, a lot of many regions in the Middle East over there, or now, can we call it? We call it Swana now, I think, isn't that more politically correct? In that region, they have versions of things, but it's kibbi or kubba, but it's like bulgur wheat, and then it's like a minced pie sort of thing, or like an empanada, but with you know, instead of the flour, it's this, we use this rice, and it's just so good, and it's like crispy. My mom makes it; it's amazing. And just, you know, there's not really anything specifically. So, okay, a big Iraqi dish is called mezguf, which is a fish that they put in, like, if you go down to El Cajon and all down south over by, like, San Diego, that they have all of those, like, authentic restaurants, but it's like a wood fire kind of pit that they put this, and it's called the tanur, and they put the fish in there. And I like the concept of it. I mean, I like fish, but I also prefer, I'm lazy, I don't want to debone. But yeah, a lot of just, like, just all of the things, like, I, you know, tabbouleh. I just love how it's a very vegetarian based, you know, cuisine. And I love that. But yeah, the food, I love the food. And then I love the, in weddings, the debka, which is why a big part of why I made the short is I wanted to showcase that. I cannot do it myself. I don't know why. It's a very regimented dance, but I cannot get it. So I have two left feet. I can't do it. And I thought, well, I need to, you know, I love them. It's like the Iraqi chobi beat, which is like a very, like, a percussive, and
yeah, it's beautiful. It's
really, you know, Joe, it's just very, really celebratory, and
no,
expect loud and brash and wonderful, and I love that about it. And actually, I should say, Iraqis have a lot of, most Iraqis I've met are very funny.
Yeah,
they have really hilarious. It's just like a certain way of looking at things. And so it just makes me laugh just being around.
Yeah, I did love the Debka scene in your film. It's so ecstatic. And yes, it's very connective with the beats, like you were saying. It's very like, I don't know what the term is because I'm not a musician, but like, it's very grounding. Like, you know, like, we don't have that in South Asian. We have more of like the dhol, but it's not as like interactive where the dancing is like that with that. So I think that was beautiful. So where did the idea for my so-called Iraqi wedding come from, and why the short? And tell us a little bit more about why you made this and took a break from directing and directed this.
Well, I had wanted to write a rom-com because I love them. And I thought, well, I want to write something that has somebody who looks like me and the main character. And so that the idea, it was going to be an American spin on a classic rom-com. And then it sort of evolved over the years. And I wrote it as a feature and it made the rounds, and it was optioned. And then again, this was all, and I blame everything on COVID, but it was around COVID. And ran out, and nobody did anything with it. And I thought, so I was with my partner Tara, who is in the film. She's the main actress, and we were just talking about, why don't we just do this? What are we doing? And I came out to LA to go for Loyola Marymount to be a filmmaker. And then since then, it was easier, and also they were paying me really well to sit behind a computer and edit. And I just thought, okay, well, I'm going to do this, but it's been so long, and I don't know if I'm going to enjoy it, but I'm going to make it. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I set foot on set, it was just like, why have I been away for so long? And I think the reason why is because when I was doing it, we were like low budget, everybody was doing, we were doing everything, three jobs to everybody. And now I realize, oh, you can pay people. You can have things. Wow. Okay. So it was, the idea was to make, to take this feature and condense it in a way that was a standalone, but also told us somewhat of the story. And I thought, well, if it's going to be a short, and if this is the only thing anyone ever sees, let's say it doesn't go anywhere, it would be fun to showcase this Iraqi wedding stuff, which is like the rituals and the stages and all of that kind of thing, which were fun to me. And a lot of people don't do it, or they do versions of it. And there's actually, I think, 7, but we condensed it to 5. And, I just thought that it was like, this is be a fun thing just to put out in the world. You don't see that.
I really love how you paid attention. Like, I really love the little details that made it like a comedy, but also you could tell there's drama there. But I love the dad's character and his t-shirts changing, which I don't want to give away too much because, I know you're going to go on the film festival circuit and share. But there's a lot of cute little details in the cast that you brought on, I think, really great too. So, like, where are you with this film right now? And what do you want your audience, after they see the short, my so-called Iraqi wedding, take away from it? And then what is the future goal with this film?
So we just finished post, and we had the screening that you came to was a friends and family private screening. And so we're doing that right now while we're applying to festivals. We're doing kind of this, we're working with a festival coordinator to do this sort of strategic kind of thing where we go, and then hopefully have our world premiere somewhere in the new year sometime. I don't know what the schedule is, but so to get to shed light on it, and then to hopefully raise more money to be able to make the feature.
What do you want audience and programmers who see your film take away from that, get from your film? Like, what is the message if there is more than one? Or what are you hoping that you, as a director and a filmmaker and a storyteller, people take away from your film?
Yeah, I think the joy and the chaos in this kind of culture, this ritual, this event, basically, that ends up, because I'm a big fan of, like, a lot of my stories was like, being true to yourself and what do you want versus all of the cultural expectations and, you know, doing what you want versus what's expected of you. So I just thought that would be an interesting thing to put in the set it in the world of this big, you know, wedding. And, you know, there's a line in there, like Iraqis, the one thing Iraqis love more than a party is a wedding party. And this woman who is like kind of swept along in it, and, you know, does she really want it, or is it just something that she's that's expected of her? And so I like that concept of it. I like the, how do you listen to your own heart if when everything around you is just so loud, you know? So I think that's, you know, a lot of it has been my personal journey, not with weddings per se, but just in general. I just thought, you know, who doesn't
know? I love that. I love how you just gave that standalone perspective of like how much is imposed and how much is of it your choice. So I think, and you shared this story in such a lighthearted way. I think it's going to be, I found it to be very entertaining. I smiled and I laughed a lot. And I think you did a great job in encapsulating that in a very short film, which is great as a proof of concept. So, you know, good things on the horizon for you, Acer. What else do you want to create in the future? What is your ideal collaboration? Let's say, you know, you do get to make this into a feature, but what beyond this, what else do you want to do?
I would love to do or work with at least one person on a documentary of some sort. And a documentary, I'm not sure, you know, what the subject matter is. I know people usually come from a subject matter instead of the other way. So, but I just love the idea of, my favorite thing about documentaries is how they start out being about something and then they become something else.
Yes.
So I would love to collaborate with, you know, someone or someone's on that. I would love to get back to writing. I'm working on a middle grade book, kind of, you know, sort of, I'm just starting it now. So I'm kind of formulating ideas. Okay. And I just, you know, I'd love to just keep editing, especially and things like that.
Well, that is great. Well, I think we learned a lot about you today, Acer. And I think I really want to see your future. I do want to see my so-called Iraqi wedding and a theatrical release feature, because I do think there's so much more to that story. And I think we need that. We need that film made. So hopefully we'll get everybody around and support your film. And I'm pretty sure it's going to win many awards for sure, because it's funny. You had some great characters, and I really, the look overall too, it's a beautiful film. I mean, for a short comedy. So you guys did a great job. We are at the end of our segment, so we're going to go on to our reflective questions. Ooh. What is home, Acer? How do you define home?
I sense myself getting even deeper. My instinctive thing is just like, you know, somewhere that's comfortable, where my, you know, I have cats, my cats are, you know, where my friends are, where my family is. But really a place where I can be, you know, be myself, which is, you know, sun-filled, you know, like a sun-filled room where I can take a nap.
Yes. Naps are good. Naps are good. From where you are now, what would you tell your 16-year-old self?
That it does get better. I know that's the generic answer, but... you know, I would tell my 16-year-old self to just relax, like just don't rush, you know, there's that Billy Joel song, Vienna, where it's like, you know, the line is, Vienna waits for you, slow down, you know, you don't need to like rush, everything's just chill, basically. Chill. I think when I was 16, I felt like I needed to know everything, and I felt like if I didn't know everything, that I was never going to know everything, so yeah, just relax. I would just say, it's all, you're good.
That's good advice for a lot of us, even now. Like, I mean, just like the urgency in the world is just so much. Sometimes we just all need to just take a beat, right? What are three good markers of a good community? Like what do you think is important for a community of any kind? It could be a neighborhood, a family, global community.
Well, we need to have a space that they can go to, right? A space where you can feel safe, and the exchange of hold on. You asked for three things. I'm just throwing stuff at you.
Is it good though?
right? A physical space that could also be an online space, but somewhere that they, people can go. The safety to feel comfortable expressing themselves. So that's number two. And food.
Yes.
Good food. But no, wait, number two should be like knowing that you have a supportive network.
Yeah.
That's, I think that's the key thing. That should be actually number one, is knowing the marker of a good community is knowing that you're not alone, that that somebody's got you.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Yeah. So that's great. That's awesome. Where is your next destination? Where would you like to go next in the world?
I'm a big fan of London, so I kind of want to go there, but I'm going to take my mom on a trip. I think maybe somewhere warm. I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'm not a big, you know, traveler. I should be more, but I think when you go back, going back to your home question, I like being home.
No, I mean, you're a creative. Like we do alternate. We got to have our hermit time to like, just kind of sit in our space and recharge. I think we're like houseplants. Like, you know, you need a little bit of sun and then you just got to chill for a little bit.
I like the houseplant. Yes. I like to. Yes. I love that. That's, you know, I'm going to use that analogy.
Well, this was great, Acer. Thank you so much
for
being a guest. And I learned so much about your writing, your book, your film. We're going to link all your resources on our website and share that with the audience. Where can people connect with you? They can find you everywhere, but acersalman.com. Everywhere on the social media.
I'm like Times Square billboard.
Yes.
I'm on, yes, Instagram, mainly Instagram, LinkedIn, and what are the other, and just, yeah, Acer Salman is by my full name. I don't have like the cute handle or anything like that. But I have to say, like, I have to give you, like, you, this is a really cool podcast to be a guest on, but it's also really, what a cool thing that you're doing.
Oh, thank you.
I feel like it's really, like, you really kind of, I've never been asked what my favorite cartoons were, and probably, you know, I've been worse off for it. So,
I appreciate those kind words, especially coming from such a esteemed creative like yourself. I appreciate that.
Thank you for noticing. How did you get, I want to ask you real quick, like how, what gave you the idea to do this podcast?
Short answer, not having community and not having enough empathy in the world and being on the short end of that and receiving that. So I was like, why not just create a community like that where we go a little bit deeper. I know you like short form, but I feel like in me, the lost art, a long form and just slowing down and getting to know people beyond the surface, which goes back to what you were saying about salons. That's very appealing to me too, because where you can just beyond like, how's the weather? What did you do? It's like really talk about things that matter, or that you can get to know people in community, but connect on a deeper level. So for me, that was missing. And I was just like, we just touched the surface. I know there's more to creative people and social entrepreneurs and people in innovation. They have more to why their purpose is. So let's get to the heart of that. So I was like, why not just do this? And I just started it. Like, it's our first year. So yeah, we hope to do more of these and hope to get some funding and then have a better setup and do more with this as a community building thing. Cause you know, it's important. So
it's amazing. It really is important. And I'm really, you know, it's nice to have another thing to add to my list of podcasts.
Yay. Oh, I'm excited. Well, I will tell you, this is great. And I am going to keep us posted on your Academy Museum project, because I would love to share that on our Instagram in the future and all that. But thank you so much, Acer. It was lovely having you here. We wish you a wonderful 2025.
If you enjoyed The Slow Dive, please subscribe and leave us a positive review wherever you get your podcasts. The Slow Dive is hosted by Farida Rafiq, edited by Drew Franzblatt. Our theme song is Dive by Sarah. Thanks for listening.